This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Today we have one of our so-called busy mornings. After the Dharma talk, we want to do the annual memorial for our late friend, John King. So please stay for that if you wish. And then after that, we'll have our abbreviated full moon ceremony, which I think we invented. So, all in all, it shouldn't take too long. Although somebody once said to me, the least important question you can ask about a piece of music is how long does it last? So, kind of true about ceremonies, but not entirely. And then we were going to have a birthday celebration for someone, but the birthday boy left. So now we're not sure what to do with the cake. We may have to eat it anyway. Let's see what happens. I hope everyone is well this morning. Managing to be in the realm of birth and death with no more than the usual amount of trouble. One way to look at Buddha Dharma, of course, is it's a prescription or a map for departing from the realm of birth and death. And it's often marketed that way, but when you actually start to cultivate, you start to practice, you discover that it's a little trickier than it might have been made to appear. Usually it's not long before one encounters the fine print, which says, oh, by the way, the realm of birth and death and the realm of nirvana are not two things. So that's already kind of maybe a little alarming. If, as is the case for many of us, for me, one of the, maybe the main engine for studying the Buddha way was some sense of our own suffering, if we're informed that our own suffering is inseparable from our own liberation, this might be a little disappointing. So, if any of you are disappointed this morning, I suggest hang on a little longer and trust that in a very important sense, what Buddha said is true. And that there is a way out of samsara, but it's not the way that you thought. Some people might object that, well, wait a minute, Buddha didn't say, you know, there's a way out of samsara, but it's not the way that you thought. It's like, that's not in any Pali text. It's like, well, can't help that. See, as we say, sometimes the power of Buddha's great vows is such that it's actually not really limited to the years of his literal presence on earth. about which we're also a little unsure. People disagree as to when exactly those years were and how many of them. So, as usual, we're left with a kind of a shroud of uncertainty, which is where our practice happens. And we're invited to have a seat in the midst of this shroud of uncertainty and learn that the heart of practice beats very strongly and regularly right there. And that you can actually learn very soon and very fast if you just, you know, kind of take heed to the instructions that we've been presented with over many centuries now. And of course, immediately you may think, well, which instructions? There having been, by now, a huge pile of them. And which are the right ones, since they seem to contradict each other? For instance, all the talk about the kind of the silent, radiant nature of mind, and how it's kind of covered over, and that we get to uncover it. It kind of flies in the face of other instructions which say there is that radiant nature and it's not covered by anything. So don't spend your time trying to uncover it. Well, I'm afraid that to some degree, anyway, you will have to make your own decision about that, and your karma will help you. You will be inclined, in one way or another, to make some choices and decisions about your practice, and I think that's great. Especially if you're a Californian, because pretty much whatever you want to do, you'll find other people to do it with. And that, of course, is Sangha, and that's critically important to our practice. You either get all three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or you don't get any. So it's good to keep that in mind. I was browsing around, as I often do, usually later in the week, looking for something to talk about today, and I ran across Master Shengyun, the late Master Shengyun's discussion of the 10 ox herding pictures. And I thought, oh, that might be interesting. I'm sure we've talked about the ox herding pictures before. And but by now, I've given so many Dharma talks that like a long-running favorite TV series will eventually start to repeat the episodes just because that's how it works. So so Master Shengyun, as you know, was a very popular and revered Dharma teacher, first in China and then also in the West. He was very clear about the practice, that there is such a thing, and what he would frequently call the method. And in his lineage, which apparently incorporated both the Linji house and the Caodong house, the two surviving houses of Chan or Zen practice. So there were two methods, and one is practicing with the Hua To, the head word, which is a snippet from a Zen story, or silent illumination, So Mojiao Chan or Kanwa Chan, those are the two methods. And he said, so if you undertake the practice wholeheartedly and apply the method, you will get the result. And of course, this is very straightforward and I think very encouraging to people. He was also careful to remind folks that you can't really plan on the result, although the temptation is strong. For instance, if I think that the way I feel about myself in the world most days is kind of crummy, then the result would be I wouldn't feel like that. I would get rid of all that. So he says actually that it's something like that. For instance, he says, as you cultivate, the confusing activity of mind, or of, might as well say, of being, which is constantly manifesting phenomena, and each phenomenon is insisting that you pay attention to it. Gradually, this frenetic process will slow down and cease. And eventually, the nature of mind, or the nature of our being, will be evident to you. And at that point, from then on, continued cultivation will result in a slow but perhaps steady decrease in the phenomena associated with greed, hatred, and confusion. So he said, one of the illustrations, one of the I guess Chan or Zen versions of Pilgrim's Progress, you might say, is the 10 ox herding pictures. And just to refresh your memories, it's actually not entirely clear whether the little paintings, and there's many, many versions of the paintings, whether the paintings showed up at the same time or before or even after the names of the pictures and the verses that go with them. Because the pictures are not actually essential. The explanation or description is in the little poems that go along with each titled event involving the ox. So first there is searching for the ox. And then there's glimpsing the tracks. Then there's glimpsing the ox itself. Then there's catching the ox. Followed by taming the ox. Followed by riding the ox home. Followed by quietly at home, ox forgotten. And then both self and ox forgotten. And then returning to the source. And finally, entering the marketplace. These are these 10 little stages. And Master Shen Yun is also careful to say this is just one story that is told. And those stages may occur in any order, depending on the person. And they may not all occur. And maybe more will occur than the 10 that are listed. So it's important not to get hung up on this particular description, any more than we visit a museum and see a painting that we like, we decide, that's the only painting worth paying attention to. That would be somewhat limiting. The same is true, by the way, in the Caodong house, the Soto house, for instance, of the teaching of the five ranks. Since they're kind of numbered 1 through 5, people sometimes think, well, you start with 1 and eventually you get to 5. It's like, actually, no, that's not how it works. They can appear in really any order. And some may appear, some may not, or more than the 5 may appear. Who knows? So it's best not to get too hung up on the details. Still, it may be helpful to have a tale to tell about practice that is, in the main, we hope, encouraging. That's the main purpose, is to give us some encouragement in our practice so that we can persist in the practice and, as Master Sheng Yun would say, apply the method. Although we're not quite so literal about that. There is a method, but it's also a non-method. How's that for a Zen expression? Kind of the way it is in the Soto house. The method is, in fact, a non-method. It's good, right? That gives you a lot of big field to wander around in. So at first, you're searching everywhere for the ox, you know? The entire world looks like 18th and Castro at 9 p.m. on a Saturday. Where in this mess is the ox? That is, I don't know, the truth. Who I am, who things are, what things are. Where is that? So, the poem has a wonderful last line, something like, all he hears is the song of the cicadas and grasses. So it's like, right there we have arrived, okay? This is why we say, don't get hung up on the order, because the poet is telling us that the little oxherd person has already found the ox. The singing of the cicadas is broadcasting, if you like, the voice of the ox. But our ox herder is a little impatient, compelled by habits of one sort or another. That won't do. So off he goes, wandering through the hills, uphill and down dale, and across streams, and through forests, and so forth. And so at one point, after practicing and applying the method, the ox herder glimpses something. He sees like a path. One of those faint but visible paths you see in the forest that the critters who live there have used. It's like, oh, I think that's it. And look, there's a footprint. So this is a sense that we develop after cultivating a while, that there is a kind of direction. There's a kind of orientation of the body-mind that makes sense as practice. So this is kind of encouraging, right? So we remind ourselves about that path and we start to follow, keeping kind of our nose to the ground. Right? And then at some point, with the flowering of our practice, we actually, so to say, glimpse, get a quick view of the ox itself. It's like our own true spiritual heart stands up and salutes us in the midst of this world that we live in. And of course, that sounds sort of dramatic, and it could be, but also it need not be particularly dramatic. The poem about that picture says something like, the ox's nose reaches the heavens. There is nowhere he can hide. This is a description of the world viewed with clarity, without all of the confusing stuff that's going on affecting our vision. There's the ox. This is even more encouraging than seeing the tracks. Our whole body kind of vibrates a little bit with the rightness of this sense that, oh, here I am. Oh, here we are. Oh, here it is. Oh, this is, again, this is like, I forget where we are, number 3 or something, but one could go through all of these 10 in a day, or in an hour, or even in a moment. But then in the traditional story, the next one, of course, is you catch the ox. First, it seems like, almost like, this is a random glimpse. And it's really great, but you kind of have no clue where the beast actually is. So next, you actually lay hold of the animal. And that means the certainty of our body-mind in its place in the realm of the Buddha way is now just about unshakable. So it's no longer just a quick glimpse. It's a sense that not only here we are, here I am, here it is, but this is always so. This is an inalienable understanding in our deep tissues. Then next, it's like, well, now you gotta tame the ox, because left to itself, the ox kind of loves to wander around into the neighbor's garden and eat all their flowers and stuff. And it's like, that's actually not that helpful. At that point, you could conceivably, you could go live in the mountains and live mostly on rice and plum wine and just kind of hang out there and write cool poems. And that's okay, but that's very advanced practice. And for most of us, if we experiment with that too soon, we'll actually wind up living in a way that's not very helpful. So this notion of taming the ox means the power and efficacy of confronting or being confronted by true nature needs to be available to others as well as ourselves. So taming the ox means has something to do with availability to help other beings. And it requires, again, some continuing practice, continuing to apply the method, whatever that is, and letting the process of maturation happen of itself. Then eventually, the sense that we are in training kind of falls away. And this is called riding the ox home. And the little picture is very, very pretty. There's the ox. The ox herd is playing a flute and not even holding any reins or anything. And the ox is just wandering off home, since the ox definitely knows where it lives. So this is, if you like, the method internalized completely. So you hardly even think about practice anymore as something separate from your life. And this continues, right? Eventually, ox and ox herd, they get home. Then the ox, you just let it, put it out to pasture. And in that little picture, the ox herd is sitting at a little table inside, looking out the window at the lovely mountains in the evening. And it says the whip and the rope are unused in a corner. So this is like, again, training? What's that? This is exactly our life. This marvelous, inexhaustible resource is just our life. So that's like home alone, ox forgotten. And then there's even a point where one isn't even home alone. Both ox herd and ox are forgotten. And that picture is just a lovely tree by a stream. No ox, no person. This is even further integration. And such a person may be completely unrecognizable as a, you know, I don't know, an adept or a cool Zen guy or gal. It's like, what is any of that? It's nothing of any value. And then even nudge it just a little further and say, then there's number 9, returning to the source. And that painting is, as you know, is just an empty circle. So this is, Dogen says, you know, with the eye of practice, the eye of awakening, the whole realm of practice is nothing but drifting white clouds for 10,000 miles. And even that is too much. Even that goes. So then, basically, it's kind of like there's nothing until the alarm clock goes off in the morning and you open your eyes on a day. And then, you get dressed and go back to the marketplace where there are many, many, many suffering beings just like there were before. And you're bringing with you your sense of this inexhaustibly beating heart in the Buddha way. Without any awareness that, oh, cool, I'm carrying around the inexhaustible beating heart of the Buddha. None of that. No baggage. Quite naturally, you hear the cries of the world and you respond as best you can. This is entering the marketplace with, as they say, bliss bestowing hands. Bliss bestowing hands, who knows, you know, could be giving the homeless person a quarter or someone a firm handshake, saying good morning to your co-workers. We cannot exhaust those possibilities. They are limitless. And the bliss, again, is not even a feeling that we can recognize. That is how fine and subtle and pervasive it is. So, this is one version, one story, one myth or fairy tale about the path of practice, the 10 ox herding pictures. And as I say at the end, I think having described this, Master Shengyan says, remember, these don't necessarily appear in any order. And for one person, the way the story unfolds may be quite different from another. After all, people are unique. Therefore, why wouldn't their own story of practice be unique? When we have the so-called way-seeking mind talks, in practice where each person talks about how he or she came to practice the Buddha way, pretty quickly, you see everyone unique, unique story. Therefore, in a sense, what they will bring to the marketplace is also unique. intimately connected with just who they are, just being themselves. One such person is our old friend, John King, whose memorial we will have shortly. He, of course, would tut-tut any such assertion. That was the way he was. But anyway, those of us who knew him would say, yeah, he's one of those marketplace people with bliss-bestowing hands. So I think that's probably even longer than I was going to talk anyway, so maybe you all have some questions or comments? Yeah. I was just going to say, I hear the cicadas singing. All right, go ahead.
Sorry.
It's all right. No, go ahead. No, it's more okay. Cicadas.
I guess the ox herding pictures to me feel like one of those Buddhist toys, you know. Mm-hmm. But it feels like there's the very lofty teachings, the Master Judin, the one finger charm, and those sort of things. It feels like in Sangha, there's the practice of encouragement involves these different toys, if you like, or different stories. Or
can do.
Well, I'm trying to say,
would you rather have more toys or fewer toys or no toys at all?
I guess I'm saying I do find toys helpful at times. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, so do I. Mm-hmm. Probably my favorite toys are those Zen stories. I don't know why that is. I didn't set out to make that true, but it just seems to have happened. Other people loathe them, as you probably know. And other people want altogether a different set of toys, so they wind up practicing Tantra, which seems like all toys, you know. It's like one of those shops in Harry Potter land. It's just floor to ceiling stuff to play with, and that can be helpful too. So of course at some point they remind you, by the way, the toys have nothing to do with anything. That's when your practice of Tantra matures, at which point it starts to look very like practices and vice versa. It's just how it is, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that there's no way for us to relate, you know, in a personal way without toys.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it is. I hate to, it, in a way, it feels profane to say they're helpful, strangely, but.
But strangely, they are.
Yeah.
I think so. Well. Another way of enjoying the song of the cicadas is we do little ceremonies, so maybe we could put the zendo kind of back together, only to take it apart again for the next thing, but that's all right. And then I'll come back in a couple of minutes, and we'll do Chan's very brief ceremony, and then we'll do the 21st century San Francisco version of the full moon ceremony, which is very short, too. Anyway, thank you all for your practice, as usual. Please take care.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place.